This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. University of Virginia political analyst Larry Sabato says it is time to revisit the U.S. Constitution in order to improve our system of government. On March 29, 2008, Sabato spoke in city council chambers as part of a Virginia Festival of the Book program sponsored by the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. Over the course of the hour-long lecture, Sabato discussed 23 proposals to revitalize the Constitution and make America a fairer country. That's the subject of Sabato's new book, A More Perfect Constitution. Sabato is introduced by Robert O'Neill, president of the Thomas Jefferson Center.
I'm Bob O'Neill, director of the Thomas Jefferson Center, delighted to have the chance to sponsor this exciting event. Anyone here interested in politics? If so, you're in the wrong place, because today we're going to talk about the Constitution. But a little politics may creep in along the way. It used to be that a member of the UVA faculty visiting at another institution would say when political issues arose, well, you know, my colleague Larry Sabato is an expert on such things. Now, of course, it's very different. Anywhere around the country, around the world, political issues come up and they point to you and they say, you're at UVA. What does Larry Sabato have to say about this? Because as we all know, and as we treasure that knowledge in this community, he is the preeminent expert on a whole host of issues affecting American government and governance. In my modest view, this is a book that should be read not only by anyone who teaches about the Constitution or about American government, but ought also to be read by anybody who studies American government or our Constitution. Since its publication last summer, the book has predictably evoked a lot of discussion, some controversy. I think my favorite review was one entitled, Irreverent Son Takes on Founders. Turned out actually it was a fairly favorable review, and the concluding sentence is this. When it came to drafting the original Constitution, no one outpaced the Virginians, which makes it all the more apt that an audacious challenger should spring from the same well. Many of the proposals in this book are controversial. Indeed, I'll confess, Larry, I have some real trouble with your recommendation about abolishing lifetime tenure for federal judges. But it wouldn't have had the kind of impact it's had unless, in some way, everybody's ox got gored at some point. That just happens to be mine. But that's not the point. For me, the most revealing sentence in the entire book is this one. I believe that Washington, Madison, and Jefferson would be the first to insist that the words that ended up in the Constitution are not the final word, and they would encourage us to start thinking about constructive changes in the constitutional framework. So it seems to me there are only two prerequisites for coming here, as I'm delighted to see all of you have done. First, that you come with an open mind. And second, a belief that some part of our constitutional structure or governance might work better than it does today. Just a couple of very brief announcements. Copies of Larry's book are here, and I don't think he'd object to signing them or having you buy them at the end of the session. I get no commission, so I can shamelessly promote the book. I think it's a very good cause. We are being broadcast live on TV Channel 10. Finally, this room tends to get a bit warm even when it's empty. When it's full, as it is now, it gets even warmer. There is absolutely nothing that the city of Charlottesville or anyone else can do to make it cooler, so I just enter that caution in advance. Now to the pièce de résistance. Larry, thank you so much for letting us sponsor this event. We are honored and delighted to be here this noon.
Thank you, Bob. Bob, thank you very, very much. I appreciate your generous introduction. Now, look, that was so generous, it was incredible. You know, I am the kind of person who expects at least half the time to be devoted to criticism. That's normally what happens. I should show you my email and my snail mail sometime. It's just amazing what people will write you and what they will say and how they will say it anymore. That's the problem with the internet. People don't calm down before they write. But we're in a controversial business, both of us. Let me thank you for having me. And it's my pleasure to be with you and under your sponsorship. And congratulations to you on a very distinguished career and on your upcoming semi-retirement. You will never retire. I'm quite certain of that, nor should you. But we thank you for the many years of devotion to the University of Virginia. And I also want to mention my old professor. I still young at heart, Henry Abraham over there. Bob, you will be delighted to know that during this never-ending campaign, I've been mainly on the road. In fact, I missed all your excitement this week. I had to watch it on television, the snipers and this and that and the other. I was glad not to be here. But I was in four states not named Virginia, and my substitute teacher is Henry Abraham. He's coming in and lecturing now before my classes, and I have gotten a number of emails from students asking me not to come back. So I want to congratulate Henry on the great job he's doing, and he is as great a lecturer as he was when I was a student. He's gotten even better. So it's good to see you here, Henry, and I know he's got the next program which you'll want to stay for right after this. Now, I've been told that we need to wind up about 1:15, including questions. And I think that's exactly the right length. I'm certainly going to talk about the book, and Bob was absolutely right. He only left out one thing. I always say the book makes a great holiday gift. Any holiday, Mother's Day, Father's Day coming up. But don't you think they get tired of flowers and ties? Wouldn't you like to salute them intellectually? You know, and they would be impressed, with a book like this. So anyway, just a suggestion. We're not shy in our business. I learn from the best in politics. I'll open up actually with a couple of stories from this week. I was in North Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Texas. And I only know I'm back in Charlottesville because I recognize the city council chamber. But I had two very interesting events happened wholly apart from the presidential politics. And by the way, you can ask some questions about presidential politics. If you agree to buy the book, I wouldn't even talk about it. It's not a problem. We can make a deal if you want to do that. They both actually relate to this book, because what I tried to do in this book, and I've never had more fun writing a book, I wanted to stir the pot. And Bob is absolutely correct in suggesting that no one, absolutely no one, will agree with all 23 of these ideas. And I have a little surprise for you. I don't agree with all of them. Several were directed to me, really, by the national survey that we took of how people viewed government and what they thought ought to change. And I went ahead and adopted several ideas strongly supported by massive majorities of the public, ideas I do not personally support. But I did it because it's the people's government. And I made the best arguments that I could for the ideas they selected. And then, of course, I added my own and completely ignored public opinion for the rest because I have tenure. I feel that, that gives us a right. That gives us a right. One day they may take it away, and then we'll have to be more concerned about public opinion. Maybe it'll be a good thing. Maybe it'll be a bad thing. But anyway, the first incident I was going to tell you about happened down in Alabama, and I came across someone by the name of Albert Brewer. Does anybody here recognize the name Albert Brewer? Oh, my goodness, Governor Holton, of course you would recognize it. Hi, Jinx, how are you? I'm delighted to see you all here. Woody, how are you? And Woody has a terrific new book on the Constitution, too, Unruly Americans, which I highly recommend to you. Is that the one? These two books make wonderful companion holiday gifts. Did I do that right? Governor, tell them who Albert Brewer is.
He succeeded George Wallace as governor of Alabama when George...
Lurline. He succeeded Lurline.
Yeah.
He was the real governor, yeah. And that is incredible. I'm just so, first of all, I'm delighted to see you all here. I didn't.
And he was an outstanding governor of South Carolina with a very moderate approach to the races.
But that is exactly the heart of it. Well, he was governor of Alabama. He succeeded Lurline Wallace, and the governor is correct that it was George Wallace was really the governor, and you were absolutely correct to say George Wallace. Wallace simply ran his wife to get over the one-term limit, and I was shocked that you didn't run Jinx in 1973. I've got to tell you, she would have made a great governor.
Oh,
Ann is going to run. That would you know, solve the Democrats' problem for sure there. This is turning into a riot. I haven't even gotten into the substance of the book, but Governor Holton knew, obviously, Albert Brewer, because you overlapped there, I guess, a year. He had succeeded Lurline Wallace when she died of cancer. Incidentally, just to show you how different things were then, I asked him. We had a chance to sit down and chat for a while, and I'd never met him before, and he was really one of my heroes in the 60s. He was the only progressive governor Alabama ever had, and it was by accident. He was lieutenant governor, and Lurline Wallace died halfway through the term of cancer, but they hadn't given any of the details out, and Albert Brewer had heard through the grapevine that it was serious, but he didn't know how serious. And one night at 10:30, got a call from George Wallace saying, you might want to prepare to take over. She may not make it through the night. And she did pass away that evening, and that's how he became governor. But he decided, I think very correctly, that he might be governor only for that 2.5-year period. He succeeded in June of 68 when Wallace was running for president in that horrible campaign of his in 1968, which was purely racist. And Brewer knew very well, number one, that Wallace couldn't win the presidency, and that, number two, Wallace would be bored instantly, not being in public office, and would run for governor again. He knew right away that he would have only 2.5 years to serve as governor. So he decided to put it to good use, and he revoked many of Wallace's racial policies. He appointed African-Americans to a wide variety of positions. And remember, this is the mid-60s in Alabama. That was not easy to do. It's easy looking back to say, oh, well, of course, but not really. And he was just a marvelous, marvelous gentleman. And we talked mainly about the 1970 campaign. He's well in his 80s, I guess, at this point. I didn't ask him how old he was, but I know he's in his 80s. And he told me about the 1970 campaign. That was back when the Democratic primary in Alabama was still tantamount to election, which you broke up here in Virginia in 1969. But they knew the election would be in the primary, election of the next governor, and it was Brewer versus Wallace. And everyone assumed that Wallace would win easily. But Brewer ran an excellent race, a hard race. He was the incumbent. And he put it to the people of Alabama this way. He said, we can continue to live in the 19th century, or we can join the 20th century and think about change and think about progress and make a better life for the people of this state. And to, I think, everybody's surprise, he nearly won. It was a few thousand votes. He actually led the first primary, and then in the runoff, he lost by just a few thousand votes to Wallace. And, of course, Wallace took over again, and then he got the one-term rule changed, and he served 8 years. He was out for a term, came back in. Poor Alabama. I mean, literally, Alabama was under the yoke of George Wallace for decades. And the lesson that I learned from Brewer was that every now and then, societies, whether they're national societies or whether they're state societies, have the opportunity to change for the better. And they can either take that opportunity or they can waste it. Now, Alabama almost took the opportunity, but so often in American history, you find that those opportunities slip away, and frequently by a narrow margin. A lot of people recognize the opportunity, but not quite enough. And I think this relates to some of the matters that I've discussed in the book, some of the changes that I think ought to be made in the Constitution. I identify some time bombs that exist in the Constitution that will cause us problems at one time or another. It would be wonderful for a change to anticipate the problem and solve it in advance instead of waiting for the time bomb to explode, just to mention one that no one ever discusses. And it's just so completely outdated. It's one of the 23 changes. Actually, it's just a piece of 23 changes, is the unit rule in the presidential deadlock. that would occur if the Electoral College could not reach 270 for any particular candidate. And then, of course, the front runners would go to the House of Representatives, and there would be a vote by the House, but not in the way that most Americans think. And we tested this out, and the vast majority of Americans, first of all, were unaware of what would happen at all. They had no clue what would happen if the Electoral College could not get 270 for anybody. But of those who knew, most thought it was one person, one vote, that each representative would have one vote. That's pretty much the way we're used to thinking about our system today, correctly so. That principle was established by the Supreme Court in the 1960s, and it's now almost universally accepted. One person, one vote. It's the basis of redistricting and reapportionment and all the rest. It's not perfect, but it's a pretty good basis. Well, that's not how the system works at all. In the Constitution, each state is designated as a delegation. Each state delegation will have one vote. And you have to get 26 of the 50 states to win the presidency in the House of Representatives. Well, first of all, you can imagine right there how distorted the representational system would be in the selection of a president. But it gets worse because multi-member delegations can easily deadlock. They may not cast their ballot. The giant California delegation may disfranchise tens of millions of Californians, or Texas, or New York, or Florida. Meanwhile, all the single member representative states, assuming the members are not schizophrenic, will be able to make a choice. Now, they have to get to 26, but can you imagine what will happen if a president is selected by, and this is actually true, 17% of the American public, because 17% of the public elects 51 of the senators, and 17% of the public under this system, under the unit rule system, could elect a president of the United States. We'd have a revolution, properly so. I know it would be changed for the future, but what would we do for that presidential term when someone is serving who is so completely unrepresentative, potentially, of the broader public? Why not solve it in advance? No one would object to this. In fact, this change has now been submitted as a constitutional amendment by a coalition of liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that eventually, and you know how long it takes for a constitutional amendment, that eventually this will go through. Our local representative, Virgil Goode, who I know is not very popular in Charlottesville, nonetheless, he's one of them who submitted this change because it's not ideological. Anybody can see that it needs to be done. That's just one example of what I've identified as some time bombs in the Constitution. Why? We haven't thought about them since the 1780s. We simply take as gospel whatever's in the Constitution. Well, the founders did a great job in many respects, and I'm certainly not proposing changing the Bill of Rights. There may be aspects that we might like to change. Not going to do it. Not going to touch it. Because it would kill any efforts at constitutional reform on a broad-based basis. However, after 220 years, I rather think, with all the new inventions and all the changes in society and our culture, there are many changes that need to be made. After all, the founders didn't even believe in mass democracy, as Woody discusses. And there were economic bases to the choices made at the Constitutional Convention. They didn't believe in political parties. They didn't believe in the kind of mass democracy we accept as the norm today, as essential to our functioning as a republic. So with all, and they changed their minds in their lifetime, at least some of them did, certainly about political parties, if not about mass democracy, and they had to accept mass democracy, those that were still living at the dawn of the Jacksonian era. But this to me is at the heart of the question. Do we continue to pretend that the Constitution was handed down to Moses on the Mount? Or do we accept the fact that the Constitution was a series of compromises meant to suit the times, their times? And I would submit to you that the founders were the first to recognize the Constitution would need to be changed. Now, Woody, in his book, and so many other books are like this. You know, Woody's led a star-studded life. And he went to all the celebrities he knew, and he got He got blurbs for the back cover. You know, and Governor Holton's got a new book out. It's called Opportunity Time. And it's a great book. By the way, it comes from, and Woody told me about this years ago. Woody was one of my first students, and boy, I could tell you stories about Woody Holton, but I won't, because he can tell you stories about me. But in any event, when they were kids growing up in the governor's mansion, Governor Holton every morning would come in and wake them up at 6 or 6:30 screaming, "Opportunity time!" Now, that is child abuse under the law. And the governor could have been prosecuted. Fortunately, no one knew about it at the time, but now everyone's going to know with this book. But anyway, Woody did the expected thing. He went and got blurbs from celebrities, you know, that he'd met at cocktail parties. And, of course, the celebrities never read the books. Their assistants look through it and, you know, come up with a sentence or two. You know, let's be honest about it. Come on, Woody, you're not fooling anybody. Yeah. Well, and they all say the same thing. They all say, you can boil it down. They all say the same thing. It says, "I laughed, I cried, it's better than cats." Every blur. Every one of them. I know. They'll let them find that out when they look at your book. I'm trying to get them to look at your book. Instead, I wrote early backing for a more perfect constitution, and my blurbs are supplied by Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington, and George Mason. And of course, we all here in Charlottesville, and you end any argument with a quotation from Mr. Jefferson, so I expect no dissension in this room. As Mr. Jefferson wrote to Mr. Madison in 1789, "No society can make a perpetual constitution. The earth belongs always to the living generation. Every constitution, then, and every law, naturally expires at the end of 19 years. If it be enforced longer, it is an act of force and not of right." And Madison wrote back to Jefferson, who, of course, was in Paris at the time, agreeing with him. Of course, I don't know whether Madison really believed this or not. But he wrote back, "It would give me singular pleasure to see this principle first announced in the proceedings of the United States and always kept in their view as a salutary curb on the living generation from imposing unjust and unnecessary burdens on their successors." And Washington went even further and said, "I do not think we, the founding generation, are more inspired, have more wisdom, or possess more virtue than those who will come after us." And he encouraged constitutional change. The paperback is coming out in June, and I've been sent a wonderful, and it's cheaper. Get a hardback and then get the paperback. It's revised. There'll be new information in there, so you'll want to get both. But somebody sent me a wonderful citation from John Adams. Of course, John Adams, as we've learned from that HBO series, was a bit ornery, and he was sent a letter late in life by a young person. I've forgotten where he was from. But it was a letter often written by a young person who's been taken in or is sucking up or whatever you want to call it to an older established person in the field. And the young person said, "Oh, Mr. Adams, I read everything you've written. I read everything the founders have written. May we always be guided by your thoughts. We don't have to do any additional thinking. You've done it all for us." And Adams wrote back and said, "Young man, I should congratulate you because you're showing some respect, unlike so many people in your generation. But you are completely wrong. And if your attitude prevails, we're done for." That's essentially what he said in his reply. He said, you ought to be working on improvements to the system because every generation has that obligation. And that will be on the back cover, too. They're all free after all this time. You don't have to pay them. But I think Adams was right. The other founders were right. We ought to be devoting some time and energy to this. It won't be easy. It won't happen quickly. Many of the changes that I proposed and that others have proposed, we have a website, amoreperfectconstitution.com, and we encourage people to write a 24th amendment, a 24th proposal for change. And we've gotten dozens and dozens and dozens of them, some incredibly wacky, even wackier than mine, and others not so wacky. We've gotten threats. I got one letter. I didn't worry about it. I got it from a gentleman who indicated he had a large gun collection and was going to take care of me in order to save the Constitution of the Founders. I didn't worry because it was from Alaska, And there's no way he was going to spend the money and time to come down here to take care of an author of a book on the Constitution. A little bit more seriously, I don't know if you've been on Diane Rehm. I encourage you to do that show for your book. It's a great, great show. She's terrific. She actually lets authors present their ideas as opposed to talking over them a la Chris Matthews. So I was on there talking about this book, and we got an email, and she takes emails as well as calls. And this email was from a fellow named George, I won't use his last name, from Southwest Virginia, who claimed to be the closest living relative to James Madison. I don't know how you determine these things. But he indicated that he also was planning on using his gun collection to protect the Constitution and take care of me. Well, I was delighted to have the opportunity because just the day previous, I had received a letter from a gentleman who was the head of the Descendants of James Madison Society, praising the book and saying that Madison would have endorsed many of the changes and that he wanted to see them enacted. So I started a family feud among the Madisons. I don't think they'll appear on the TV show. But, clearly Americans will be divided about many of these ideas. But the point is we need to start thinking about the changes that ought to be made. It will take generations. That's the way the Constitution, the revisional procedures in the Constitution were devised. It will take a long time to get anything passed, but that's okay. We want to think about it very, very carefully. At the very least, I hope that this book would encourage people to read the Constitution. More Americans know the Three Stooges, the names of the Three Stooges, than the names of the three branches of government. So if we could just get people to read the current Constitution, I'd be thrilled. I wouldn't be in nirvana, but I would be thrilled if I could get them to read it. Chief Justice Roberts said on a C-SPAN program in August of 2006, the one thing people don't do, and by that I mean law professors, he said that. Bobby didn't mention you, but he said it. Judges, law students, normal everyday citizens, nobody reads the Constitution. We talk about it a lot. We have cases about it. But to actually sit down and read it doesn't happen very often. And it's a very rewarding exercise. He has a less favorable view of my book. I got a very unpleasant letter from him. The only factual error we have in this book that's been reported to me or that we found was a small error about the career of the current Chief Justice, which we're correcting in the paperback edition. That wasn't what he was upset about. He was upset about the term limits that I was proposing for justices. And my main bit of contemporary evidence was a fellow who worked in the Reagan Justice Department who prepared a memo calling for 15-year terms for judges. His name was John Roberts. And I unearthed that and put it in the book. That's what he was going to see. When people write you letters, Governor, and complain about something, that often it's not really what they're upset about. They're upset about several other things, and they don't mention them because they can't really defend it. Because he said it. He wrote it. So he wrote me a letter and pointed out the error in his background and went through all the details and how outrageous it was. And he concluded by saying, if there is ever another edition of this book, you might want to correct it so that you will have a more perfect book. And, on behalf of the University of Virginia, I'm going up to see him in September to give him a paperback copy because we have to smooth these things over. I mean, if we ever have a case before the Supreme Court, we're finished. So I've got to do that. And I'll be very nice. Anyway, I don't analyze the court. I leave that to Bob and Henry, and they can say what they will about that. I'm just going to mention some of the changes because I don't want to give away the plot. You have to read the book, but some of these are really outlandish. But I defend them as best I can. I actually support this one, never be adopted, because you need the support as you read the Constitution, really, of all 50 states, and you'll never get it. And this would be changing the representative nature of the Senate. I mentioned to you earlier that 17% of the American public elects 51 senators. And that means, obviously, that if those 17% hang together in their representation, as they frequently do on funding formulas, transportation money, education money, it means that 17% of the people are frustrating the will of 83% of the people. I'm totally opposed to tyranny of the majority. But how about the tyranny of the small minority? Shouldn't we be concerned about that too on occasion? Doesn't that worry anybody? It does me. And it's worse than that, because under the rules of the Senate, which also ought to be changed, but probably never will, you only need 41 of the 100 senators to stop anything from happening. Well, how many Americans elect 41 senators? As few as 11. So 11% of the people can run the other 89%. Now, I know there's many of you here who don't want government to do very much, and I have to admit, the longer I study government, the more politicians I come into contact with, the more sympathy I have for that point of view. I've seen what happens. You know, it's not, the civics textbooks don't describe the process very well in many cases. However, again, that seems extreme to me. So I propose a more representative Senate by giving the top 10 population states two additional senators and the next 15 states on the population list one additional senator, and keep it, leaving the other 25 with their two senators. I'm not trying to put anybody out of work, though there are several that I would very much like to put out of work. Don't put anybody out of work. I think this can be completely justified. And every 10 years, obviously, with reapportionment, you would reallocate the senators based on the new population totals. I'm not going to go through all 23. I call for mandatory nonpartisan redistricting for House of Representatives elections. If we could just get that one change, so many good things would flow from it. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm not running for anything, but thank you for that. I really do appreciate that. Nonpartisan redistricting is, whether it's at the state legislative level or at the federal level, really is key. And it's one of these technical process issues that a lot of people don't grasp, they don't think about, but it's really critical if you're going to change the substance of government and the policies that come from government. So I hope you'll read that section and maybe agitate, try to get that changed. And look, there are no heroes here. Both parties, nationally and at the state level, at one time or another, have strongly opposed redistricting reform when they were in charge. That's always the key determinant. There aren't any heroes. So, you know, I don't elevate one party above the other in that particular reform category. Oh, and I have a lot of fun with terms on the House and Senate, and I change the presidential term. If you want to ask about that, you can. I expand the House of Representatives to 1,000 members on the George Washington principle that it is important to keep the constituencies smaller rather than larger. Now, what about the budget that would come from that? I keep the budget in constant dollars and divide it among the 1,000 members. So they have the same budget as the 435 in constant dollars, an inflation factor in there, divided by 435. And remember, it would be a lot easier to defeat incumbents that way. It would be easier for challengers with less money to get known by smaller constituencies just by door-to-door campaigning. There are a lot of good things that can come from this. It'll never happen, but I think it's important to challenge people to think in new ways. They can reject it or they can recognize it as not possible, but they still think about the system in new ways, and that's one of our purposes. That's what academics are here for. We're not supposed to be proposing things that can pass favor in popular referenda necessarily. And I'm saying that for you, Woody. The radical things this guy has said and done over his career, really, it worries me. Okay, let's see here. Let me mention a continuity of government procedure. Nobody ever thinks about this, but we live in a different era, terrible era, when possibly, and God forbid it should ever happen, but possibly you could have at an inaugural ceremony or a joint session of Congress or the State of the Union address, a well-placed bomb could literally kill hundreds of senators and congressmen simultaneously. And we have no procedure for filling House of Representatives seats. We do for Senate. In most states, a few exceptions where you have to have special elections, but in most states, the governor gets to appoint the successor. But that isn't true for House elections. We have an old solid principle that House members must be elected, but the elections, special elections, take 6-7 months to organize, have party nominations, or even an open primary system. It takes a long time to fill the positions, and what happens if you don't have a quorum in the interim? So under this provision, allow for gubernatorial appointment of deceased representatives just until a special election can be held. Where would the appointments come from? Every member would get to designate 3 people on a list, and the governor would get to pick from those 3 people to succeed the congressman. And the member of Congress would run during the regular election with that list of 3 so that the voters would know what individuals the candidate for Congress had selected as a successor to him or her if the need be. It seems to me to be a reasonable thing to do, and it would apply in non-emergency situations too. And there are all kinds of other provisions there. It's a complicated thing, but I think it's needed. I'll mention a couple of others. Well, this one I feel very strongly about. I'm sure it will sell in Charlottesville. War-making powers. I just can't imagine that anyone can credibly argue that the founders would have supported the almost complete usurpation of war-making powers by the president. And the Congress has very little left. Yes, they have the power of appropriation. Let's get serious. They're never going to cut money off for the troops. It's deadly politically at the next election. And I think the founders very clearly wanted the war-making powers split. And they made that clear by giving the president the position of commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but giving Congress the power to declare war. We don't have many declared wars anymore. What I propose is going ahead, codifying the War Powers Act or War Powers Resolution of 1973. Yes, that gives presidents enormous power, which they already have for the first several months. But then after 6 months and at each 6-month interval thereafter, Congress, without unlimited debate, you'd have to constitutionally prohibit unlimited debate, set a time limit. Congress in both houses must agree to the continuation of the foreign troop involvement, or those troops would have to be, if even one house refused to go along, the troops would have to be withdrawn within a year. And I think we have to act constitutionally to restore the war-making balance. Now, you can say, oh, we can act politically. Yes, temporarily, I suppose, an election could, quote, solve the problem. But the two-party system being what it is, and the natural flow of power being what it is in American history, that will not solve the problem permanently. There will be many such circumstances where you will need this particular provision. And I think I think it's outrageous, the prohibition in the Constitution against anyone who is not a natural born citizen running for president. Everyone should have that dream. Now, you want to have someone having served a relatively lengthy term as a good citizen. I propose 25 years in the book. You can argue about the length of the term of citizenship, but the natural born citizen requirement wasn't even discussed by the founders. It popped up in a committee report. And it got adopted, some think, to prohibit this one or that one from getting in line for the presidency. Others believe that it was the fear that the great powers of the time, Britain, France, and Spain, might try to insert someone into the presidential line. Well, you know, today we can have Manchurian candidates without foreign powers intervening. And so the point is that once somebody's a good citizen and serves, what difference does it make? Do you know that there are 14 million Americans who are prohibited from ever running for president, even though they have been citizens for decades? Now, look, I don't know what you think of Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I can tell you this. If you go to California and talk to people there in both parties, they will tell you he's done a pretty darn good job as governor of California. Why shouldn't he be permitted to run for president? He's clearly qualified. You know, once he learns how to speak English, it would be better. You know, and I think he'd take a test. You know, he'd agree to that to run. Or Governor Granholm of Michigan, who was born in Canada. There are so many of our outstanding public servants at one level or another who can't even think about running for the presidency. And look, most of them never would. But it's the idea of being a full citizen and not being in some kind of pigeonholed second-class citizenship. And it bothers me. And I think people ought to think about this. It's not a massive change. It's a little change, but it has great meaning for those 14 million Americans. And by the way, that number includes hundreds of thousands who served in the military, including Purple Heart winners and Medal of Honor winners. You're going to tell me they haven't earned the right to run for president? This is ridiculous. And again, it's leftover. No one's thought about it since 1787. It's way past time to think about it. I'm going to skip entirely the Supreme Court changes because Bob doesn't like them. You'll have to read about them. I've got a whole chapter on adding a politics article. Many of the constitutions around the world have a politics article. We don't have one because in 1787, the founders, as I mentioned, didn't believe in either political parties or mass democracy, and the institutions they devised were anti-mass democracy, and they were geared toward the general election solely. Well, the founders, Thomas Jefferson founded a party, having said that he would rather go to heaven not at all if he had to belong to a political party. He changed his mind. You know, and today we call that flip-flopping. I've always been grateful, Bob, for being an academic, yeah. Because when we flip-flop, it's called intellectual growth.
Yep.
Say, we just grow intellectually. See, remember that, Governor Holt, the next time somebody accuses you of flip-flopping, you have grown intellectually. All right, now, the politics of the system, here's what I propose. I've got a bunch of changes. I'm going to mention one. The lottery system for regional primaries. I want to do a couple things. One is I want to reduce the influence of Iowa and New Hampshire. And if there are any Iowans and New Hampshireites in here, I really don't care. Because they've long had too much power. And by the way, I've actually had people in Iowa and New Hampshire say to me when I propose a change, you can't do that. It's in the Constitution. No, it is not in the Constitution that they get to go first. They believe that. They've been told it essentially by their politicians. So I'm proposing that we shorten the campaign. People are tired of these elections. They're tired of these elections that go on for 4 years, beginning the day after the president's elected. The race for the successor begins the day after the election. They would like to see it scoped. We're not a parliamentary system. We can't do it like Britain and other parliamentary democracies do, unfortunately, where you have a 5 or 6 week campaign and everything's focused and people pay attention, and as a result, you have enormous turnouts. We're having better turnouts, but nowhere near the European level turnouts. So what I'm proposing is that we have regional primaries dividing the country into four, and the quadrants almost draw themselves, and that the primaries don't begin until April. You have one regional primary a month, April, May, June, July, and then the conventions in August, the general election in November. And you'll say, well, what would stop people from going 3 years in advance to the first region? Here's what will stop them. On January 1st, in the halftime of the Rose Bowl, the chairperson of the Federal Election Commission is going to come on national television and face a bowl full of just four ping pong balls. And he's going to pick them out one at a time, determining the order of the regional primary, so that no one will have known where the election would begin until January 1st of the actual election year. I'll grant you that evening there will be 747s flying from the campaigns to that region. That's okay. That's all right. But we won't actually start the elections until April, as opposed to this ridiculous Iowa caucus January the 3rd with the peak of campaigning over Hanukkah, Christmas, and New Year's. I am resentful that I got no holidays this past year. Everyone is in the political system. But it's also insane to make people think about politics at that time. There's a time for everything, and I love politics, and that isn't the time for politics. So anyway, it would spare the people a lot of months of campaigning. It would eliminate the influence of Iowa and New Hampshire. It would give every state the opportunity to go first over time as a part of the first region. We're all equal, supposedly, under the law. We all ought to have, over time, an equal influence on the selection of the president. I'm going to mention one more and stop and take questions. I've got all kinds of other political changes that you may be interested in, but this one is very controversial, but I believe in it very, very strongly now that I'm not between the ages of 18 and 26. I call for a constitutional bill of responsibilities to match the Bill of Rights. And leading, there are other provisions in the Bill of Responsibilities, but among them, chief among them, is 2 years of national service. Anyone who's a libertarian in the room, you may leave now. I know how upset you are, but I believe that, young Americans ought to devote 2 years of their life to the service of their nation. Now, here's the difference between my proposal and others, other than the fact that it's constitutional. The first is that, yes, you would have the military option. And by the way, this would solve the problem that we have with if we agreed with Iraq and all the rest of it, the idea that so many of the volunteer service men and women are serving 3, 4, 5 tours, it's killing them and their families. And of course, the rest of us sit back, and unless we see those pages of deaths in the newspaper, half the time we don't even think about the fact that we're at war in Iraq and Afghanistan and internationally in other ways. So it would bring more young people into the military system and, I think, make it more diverse, which is important. The burden is falling on a relatively narrow economic segment and, to some degree, racial segment of our society. This would tend to broaden it out. Well, what other choices would people have? The logical choices, like, you know, the Peace Corps, VISTA, AmeriCorps, etc. But where my system differs and what really reduces the cost dramatically is in allowing any qualifying nonprofit group to create positions for young people to serve those 2 years in their communities so that they wouldn't be torn away from their families if they felt strongly about that. A lot of people would want to see the world or see the country, but others would not. That's how you allow for maximum choice with the millions and millions of young people who would be coming under this system. There are so many good things that can be done with this, like a national disaster strike force. Think what would have happened after Katrina. If we had had 1 million trained young people ready to move in, as only young people with their energy and enthusiasm can, into that area to help rebuild. Instead, we've had to depend on young people coming for 10 days during alternative spring break, you know, for 5 or 6 years. They learn the region in the first 5 days and spend 5 days working, and then they're back home. Think about what that would mean. Anytime there's a natural disaster, to have these well-trained young people move in. It's kind of the CCC all over again, a more elaborate, modern version of it. Well, there's an awful lot to take in. And clearly, this is a book you'll want to read over and over and over again over the years. I honestly hope that if you like any of these ideas, if you don't like them, I just want you to forget about the book and don't contact me. But if you like some of these ideas, any of the ideas, even one idea out of 23, I hope you might want to drop a line to your senators and your representative and others across the country in a position to do something about them. Yes, I propose a constitutional convention, and no, it's not the fearsome thing that people think it is. You're not going to have left-wingers taking it over or right-wingers taking it over because of the way that I try to structure it in here with elections in each congressional district. But even if that happened, then the changes from the left and right would simply die. Why would they die? Because any change from a constitutional convention, the 34 states request of Congress that they have a constitutional convention, and Congress is mandated to hold the constitutional convention, any change coming out of the National Constitutional Convention would still have to be submitted to the 50 states, which means you need 38 states to approve a new comma. And there are 20 reliable red states, and there are 17 reliable blue states, the rest being purplish to one degree or another. It only takes one house of the state legislature by one vote in 13 states to say no to anything. That's why almost nothing ever is adopted as a change to the Constitution. So you have really almost nothing to fear from the changes that can be proposed and discussed. And we have a lot to gain from change being proposed and discussed, at the very least, a much broader basis for civic education in this country. And I'm going to stop here and take some questions, Bob, if I can.
Larry, this is even better than the book. Could I take the prerogative of the chair to pose a dilemma that's been troubling me a good bit of late? Suppose somebody came along, some organization, Common Cause, somebody else, proposed a 28th Amendment, which would essentially pick up the no-brainers, a sort of fix-it package that would take the unit rule and the citizenship requirement, said, let's clean all these up in one sweep. Now, that would accomplish a fair amount of what you propose. On the other hand, it would certainly take a lot of the wind out of any movement for a broader reexamination or the convening of a constitutional convention. What would be your response to this 28th fix-it-up, no-brainer amendment?
I would thank them, give them a contribution, and try to put it on my gravestone.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'd be thrilled. I mean, look, I'm going to be thrilled if a single change gets adopted over time. Remember, I've been around the system since I was 7 years old. I got interested and active in politics in the 1960 campaign. You know, I didn't tell that. Can I just mention one other thing?
Oh.
I'm sorry to run on, but I'm an academic. I'm allowed. The second story I was going to tell you that I totally forgot about in the beginning. I went to one of the places I went to this past week was Fort Worth, Texas. And just by accident, I stayed in the hotel where John F. Kennedy spent his last night, which is now owned by the Hilton Company, isn't everything. But it used to be the Hotel Texas and so on. And they use it. It's a National Historic Landmark. I'd never thought of that. But the fact that that was his last sleep qualified it as a National Historic Landmark. And the motorcade actually started from Fort Worth. It went from Fort Worth to the airport, and then he took the 10-minute flight over to Love Field and into history. But what was interesting was on the walls there, they have all the photographs of John F. Kennedy that morning speaking at the breakfast that we've all seen photographs of and seen video from and so on with Lyndon Johnson and Jackie coming in late and the pink suit and all the rest of it. And then there were some other presentations that Kennedy made. And they had all of the speeches on the wall. He actually made a series of speeches in Texas the previous day, and he had two more scheduled that evening, one at the Trademark. Some of us have seen that. It's on the Internet. But one that is not publicized well at all, that was for that evening, the evening of Friday, November the 22nd, 1963, at a fundraiser in Austin, which had been set up. It was one of the biggest fundraisers of its time. Now, you get this. And it was being criticized because the admission price for this dinner was $100. It was a $100 a plate dinner. How things have changed. All for the worse. Even with the inflation factor. Believe me, it's worse. But anyway, I read these speeches that Kennedy gave. And what Ted Sorensen and others had done was to lay out his reelection campaign. This really was the beginning of the reelection campaign. He was trying to solve that big political problem in Texas. And as I read these speeches, they all connected. And what Kennedy was saying in every single speech was the key challenge for the United States in this decade and in all decades is to constantly prepare itself for change, to adapt as needed, and not to be tied to the old ways. Now, he wasn't talking about the Constitution, but it directly applies. It directly applies. And it's possible that these things are on the Internet. I haven't Googled them before, but it really struck home being there and reading them in that place.
We're now open. Questions, comments? Let's see. Yes, in the back.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
Brief segue to the presidential area. It's a fact that I was told, I can't verify it personally, John McCain was born outside the United States.
Correct, Panama Canal Zone.
In the Canal Zone.
And he can be challenged on the constitutional basis.
And the other
basis.
Point on that is Goldwater, now passed, was born before his state became, a state.
That's so, absolutely
so
correct.
So it has been looked at
Goldwater.
Legally before. Yeah.
Goldwater. That's correct. Goldwater. And so don't forget Romney, there. George Romney, was born in Mexico while his parents were on a Mormon mission. And if he had been the Republican nominee in 1968, I can guarantee you he would have been challenged as constitutionally ineligible. So it's come up, you're absolutely correct, it's come up over and over again. How absurd, how ridiculous. And there are always, I went back and I read the newspaper clips of the time, and there are always people who will defend it on the basis that the founders wrote it. and it cannot be changed. No, that's God in the tablets. See, that's, although I like to remember now, you know, the history of the world, part two or whatever it was. Remember, one of the tablets was destroyed. So it's possible that the Constitution was on that tablet. I don't know. If you watch that movie, it's a great movie. Mel Brooks.
In the back on this side in the red and then in the blue.
The problem is not that Katrina is a natural disaster. It's that the class and race bias that kept the levee in New Orleans from being in good shape created a post-hurricane crisis.
No,
so
that's
there's a
good
national
point.
Service agenda that could have been attended to.
That's a very good point. Absolutely.
And pass it to the next person.
You want to include those kinds of duties for these young people. You know, it's been my joy and Henry's joy and Bob's joy throughout our life, and now Woody's, to teach young people. And they're so creative, they're so energetic, they're so enthusiastic. There's just nothing they can't do. I try not to tell them the way it's going to be, you know, in a few decades. I want to hide that from them, but it's wonderful to see them at that age. And, you know, imagine putting them to work as they would want to be put to work, many of them at least, for the national good. What, we could be such a better society.
On the unit rule, your no-brainer might
Where
be...
Where are you? I can't see you. Oh, there you are. Okay.
Your no-brainer could be my not over my dead body if I'm from Wyoming or Alaska.
I don't go there anymore for that reason.
But, while certainly that may be the most egregious example of states' rights or whatever the correct term would be in the electoral system, there is that pesky electoral college. And when I think about the Electoral College, what upsets me the most, actually, is that there is no national rule about it, that the states can set the rules so that I used to live in Maine, which is Maine and Kansas being the exceptions to all or
Nebraska.
Nothing.
Nebraska
and
Maine.
Further, that none of the electors are legally bound, which it was news to me that in at least the Democratic primary process that also the so-called elected delegates are not bound. So do we have a democracy or what?
Sir, chapter four. All these things are taken care of, tied with a pretty bow, red, white, and blue bow. In chapter four, they're all solved. But look, I'm going to surprise you. I kept the Electoral College, but here's how I changed it. First, I gave additional electors to the more highly populated states to, for all practical purposes, eliminate, except in squeaker elections, the possibility that a president could be elected with a minority of the popular vote. Second, I keep electors as honorary positions. The votes are cast automatically. Faithless electors at various times, including 2000, could have changed the results of an election in various ways. In fact, we had a faithless elector in 2000. Al Gore won the District of Columbia with 80% of the vote. And one of the three electors in D.C. decided that 80% of her constituents weren't enough. She cast a blank ballot to protest X, Y, and Z. Well, the vote was 271 to 267. Gore ended up getting 266. But imagine if Gore had been ahead 270 to, 268. Boom, we're into the House of Representatives, potentially, if there had been one other, had two of the faithless electors. There are real risks there. Now, why do I keep the Electoral College? I change it, I think, to take care of the problems that have cropped up over history. But I like one thing about it. It isolates recounts. Imagine Florida 2000 going national with 300,000 precincts having to be recounted. And the lawyers getting involved at every level. And there were six states that were extremely close. Oh, my God. I mean, we never would have had a president. We would have had acting president Dennis Hastert for 4 years. So the great thing about the Electoral College, which was totally unintended by the founders, by the way, was that it isolates recounts. Let's keep the good and get rid of the bad. Chapter 4. Okay.
So I think about halfway back, yes, on this side.
The problem that I see having been in and out of government, associated with it for nearly 70 years, is that we don't have a vehicle for change. The vehicles that we have deal with problems. They deal with issues. But it's very difficult in the United States, constructed the way we are, to deal with change where you're not dealing with the problem or generally recognized issue. And whether I agree or disagree with, you know, what you have, the real problem is that we don't have a methodology, we don't have a process for being able to analyze and look at these things and then to be able to take them on. It's the closest we probably come is, that I've seen is, I guess, the Freedom of Information Act was done with a few people. But really, the Privacy Act that was passed had almost no public input, no public pushing at that time because it wasn't an issue at that time. But those are the only two things that really crop into my mind where we've had change without having issues, without having problems kind of thing.
Well, that's a very good point. It obviously suggests the difficulty that I face with these proposals and that anyone would face with trying to look ahead and prevent problems from happening. I would suggest this to you, though. Our political system is incredibly flexible and open to citizen input in most cases. There are always exceptions of individual politicians or office holders who are not receptive, but by and large, it is very, very open. The problem is civic education, the lack of civic education, the fact that Americans, for the most part, don't have the proper training in the through the school system, and I fault the schools for that. I fault those of us who are educators for that. Even at the college level, we don't have requirements anymore. You know, you're not allowed to have any requirements. It would be extremely useful for every young person in America to have a history 101 course and a politics 101 course, and you could add several more. If we could build some structure back into the educational system, even at the higher educational level, I think it would be a great advance. So I would suggest that civic education really is at the heart of this. My own Center for Politics, not to work in another sponsor here, but Center for Politics is devoted entirely to civic education and civic participation in the schools. And we now have what we call our Youth Leadership Initiative. In all 50 states, 52,000 elementary and secondary schools are enrolled in this, and what we do is supply interesting, fun civic exercises for teachers at no charge, put together by teachers that we've hired who are particularly good at this, and we pre-test it with students to make sure that at their age, they're interested in this material, and it's presented in a way that attracts them and so on. And it's made a big difference. We've had this now for 10 years, and we keep expanding. As I said, we had 52,000 schools, and we've now got close to 80,000 teachers enrolled in this. And that's a lot of teachers in all 50 states and around the world and our Defense Department schools and all the rest of it. So we're trying. We're trying some new things, and I hope that this will show up in a generation. If you're teaching young people about civics well, and they're learning what they should learn, it should show up in a generation. And then maybe we won't have a majority of Americans today believing that the President of the United States has the power to suspend the Constitution. I mean, what you don't know can hurt you.
I want to be sure that people on both sides have a chance because we've been mainly in the center here.
Where did these superdelegates come from? How long have we had superdelegates?
Since 1984. In fact, I attended one of the Hunt Commission meetings in Washington, named for Governor Jim Hunt, who Governor Holton knows well, of North Carolina. He was the head of this commission formed after the 1980 Democratic disaster, electoral disaster, which was also referring back to the 1972 Democratic electoral disaster. And the idea was to get more of the Democratic Party's elected officials into the convention so they would have more of a stake in the nomination of a president because they shared the ballot with the president, and increasingly they weren't even being elected delegate to the convention. Actually, I participated in a caucus in 1972 in this area. I won't say it was for. And I can remember we didn't elect any. We didn't elect any elected officials. They were all tainted. I remember, you know, and Woody was so much like this when he got to school. We viewed Ed Muskie, who was, you know, just a classic liberal Democrat, had been Hubert Humphrey's running mate and so on. Well, he was completely tainted because he was he had been to Kay Graham's cocktail parties in Washington, and he was part of the establishment, the Georgetown cocktail party. We had to have George McGovern. And the McGovernites didn't, when I was one of them, I will tell you quite frankly, and I've grown up since then, but we wouldn't have any elected officials because they were tainted. They were bad people just because they were in public office. And guess what? They sat on their hands in the election. They did nothing. They ran away from McGovern. They ran away from Carter in 1980. So the idea of the Hunt Commission was to find a way to reunite the wings of the Democratic Party. That's when they created superdelegates. Oddly, they mattered in their very first election. There were fewer of them back then. It didn't include the members of the Democratic National Committee in the beginning. And it didn't include all the Democratic members of Congress either. But as few as they were, they made the difference between Walter Mondale and Gary Hart. They probably chose very badly, by the way, in 1984. Hart would actually have won a higher percentage of the vote, and everyone involved in the campaign on both sides says that. But they picked Mondale because they knew Mondale, and they felt they could sell him on that basis and so on. That just goes to prove that simply because you're in high elected office doesn't mean that your political senses are any better than anybody else. But the basic principle of the Hunt Commission was a good one. It was a legitimate one. Now, with nearly 800, and the number changes daily because they're dying. Some of them are dying. I think it's down to 793, and then they elect replacements, and it goes back up to 795 and so on. But you've got all the Democratic members of the House of Representatives, all the Democratic members of the U.S. Senate, all the Democratic National Committee members. They're a majority of the superdelegates. They're not elected by anybody but the party activists at the state level. And, quote, special distinguished party people appointed by the chairperson of the Democratic National Committee, in this case, Howard Dean. It always includes all the former Democratic presidents, the Democratic vice presidents, Democratic majority leaders, Democratic speakers of the House, other key Democrats who served in this position or that position. And they're the ones who they'll have to pick. They're going to pick between Clinton and Obama. No question about it. They will make the decision because no one's going to be close on June 3rd to the 2025, or if Michigan and Florida are added even half the delegates, it'll go up to like 2,300 delegates that you'll need to be nominated. So is that Democratic, capital D and small d? Not particularly. And I'll tell you another thing that we found in this election. Many of us had never studied the rules in the 50 states. I'd always gotten the party plans, and by the way, they're stacked like this in my office. And who has time to read that stuff, right? Except this year I've had to read them because it really matters how they allocate delegates. And the Democratic Party, those of you who are active in the Democratic Party, you got a big problem. You are so fair, you are unfair. A candidate wins a state in a landslide and nets six delegates. There ought to be some bonus delegates for, you know, winning a big state as a way to wrap up the nominating process, if nothing else. The Republicans aren't encumbered by that concern about fairness, and they have a great system. Winner take all, they get a nominee like this, and boom, he's off running for the general election. You know, doing all the things that McCain is doing and running around the world with other world leaders and raising money. And, you know, if you, they need a Hunt Commission to revise the state party plans because they're nutty. Like I was down meeting with some people in Texas about their crazy system of having a primary followed 15 minutes later after the polls closed by a caucus. And of course the primary favored Clinton 51-48, and the caucuses favored Obama. They've officially counted 42% of the caucuses. This was March 4th that they had the caucuses. We still don't know what the allocation of delegates is in Texas. They're still counting the caucus results. Obama won them about 56-44, we think. But you see what I mean? This is nuts. And nobody ever had to worry about it since 1984. And now I can guarantee you the Democratic Party will have another Hunt Commission in the next 4 years to figure out how the system ought to be changed again.
We have time for one more question on this side, as people over here have not had an opportunity yet.
The part of the federal government that is most often changed is the Internal Revenue Code. What would Mr. Jefferson have to say about that?
Bob, what would Mr. Jefferson have to say? Go ahead.
He would probably decline to respond on the ground that any answer would be too contentious.
And I do, too. Thank you very much.
So... We do. If there is one more urgent question, we do have time for one more.
So, make it a good one. One we can have fun with.
In the center here? Yep.
Several state constitutions have provisions for automatic periodic submission to the voters of the question whether to have a constitutional convention. I think Illinois has that this year, Michigan in 2010. Have we had experience with that kind of process that you think is instructive, and might that be something the federal constitution could use?
Chapter 7. No, I actually propose, this is getting more and more radical, I actually propose that one of the duties we Americans should have in civic renewal in the first decade of every new century is a new constitutional convention. It may choose to change nothing, or its proposals may all be not ratified in the end. But the very process of having it will be one of the greatest civic education tools we could ever have. And I went back and I counted what the states had done in terms of revising their constitutions. I didn't count amendments. I counted full constitutional revisions. You know, if this is so dangerous, then why have the original 13 states fully, completely revised their constitutions 40 times, including once while Governor Holton was in office here in Virginia. In all 50 states, there have been 92 complete and total revisions of the Constitution with state constitutional conventions. We've survived. We've done better because of them. And we can't do it at the national level? Are we so afraid of one another that we can't do it anymore at the national level? I hope not. And I hope, as you read this wonderful holiday gift, you will come to the same conclusion. Thank you very much.
We thank you all for coming. We thank Larry especially, and the bookstore is now open.
You've been listening to UVA political analyst Larry Sabato, recorded March 29th, 2008 in City Council Chambers. Special thanks to Joe Rice at the City of Charlottesville's TV Channel 10 for helping provide the audio today. If you've enjoyed this program, please visit us at SevillePodcast.com and let us know. If you'd like to get in touch with us, the best way is to leave a comment on the blog, SevillePodcast.com.